I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 5th of May. Mondays at 1 o'clock, it's always all things political. David Zwerdlich is our guest, associate editor at TheRoot.com. We have a lot to talk about. Those of us who are complete political junkies watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner and listen to the president's remarks and the comedian's remarks. Some funny things were said. I thought we would get an analysis of that. Last week's Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, David says the tension between Roberts and Sotomayor's view is the same tension fundamentally among most Americans. We'll be talking about the president's record and how it compares with LBJ's. There was a lot of discussion about that at the Civil Rights Summit at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library in Austin. A Nevada congressman, as this is news today, is calling on elected officials to rid the town in his district of militia members who have rallied around rancher Cliven Bundy in his battle with the federal government over land. It's quite a story. These people are armed and would appear to be fairly dangerous. We'll talk about that and other stories that are in the news, political stories. You're always welcome to join the conversation. Any of you see the White House Correspondents' Dinner? What did you think? We're going to analyze some of the jokes. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So you watched the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but you didn't go. You have to go to that.
Yeah, I sure did watch it. Yeah, one of these days, before it's all said and done, I'd like to go at least once. We actually have one of my colleagues is our White House correspondent, and she went, but I actually haven't asked her how it was in person.
Well, next year you say, please, I'd like to go with you.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and she will say yes. I thought the president's funniest line was, these days House Republicans are giving John Boehner a harder time than they give me, which means orange really is the new black. That was a funny line.
Oh, that was a really great joke in every way, the president's delivery, the whoever wrote the joke, and it really captured that essence of what's going on in politics right now. I think the president, and you've said this before, I think lots of people have said this before, the president really relishes these moments because it is a way for him to step into that comedic frame and get some of the things off his chest that he otherwise really can't in other settings. And so that sort of encapsulated, and I agree with you, that was one of the highlight jokes.
Yeah. I also like the line, because he's just back from Malaysia, and he's criticizing CNN's round-the-clock coverage of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. They just did that story forever. The lengths we will have to go to get CNN coverage these days, I think they're still searching for their table.
Yeah, no, I mean, he really let them have it. Joel McHale, the comedian, who, frankly, I thought was really edgy. You know, some didn't like it, some liked it.
Yeah.
They both really lit into CNN and to a lesser extent to MSNBC. I think that we're, if nothing else in our politics, we're entering this era now as the Obama era winds to its back lap or whatever, that politicians and political observers are really letting the media have it, really letting online outlets and cable news outlets have it. And they did not spare CNN at all. I thought.
Yeah, and you would expect that they would skewer Fox News, which he did as well.
Right, no, they did skewer Fox and MSNBC, but there was actually one of the sites, maybe it was the Washington Post, I don't have the link handy, but they actually had a bar graph, if your listeners wanted to Google it up, showing how many jokes were done about each topic, and CNN got the brunt of those cable news.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I didn't see that. And the comedian, do you think he was, there's been a lot of press today about whether or not he was too hard on Chris Christie.
Well, you know, here's the thing. He I think what can fairly be said about Joel McHale, and I was not familiar with his comedy prior to that. I recognized his face, but I've never seen him perform. I think it's fair to say, Kathleen, that he was an equal opportunity offender. He went after people on the left and the right and across the board. He really did bear down on Chris Christie. I think on the one hand, Chris Christie could fairly expect to be the butt of a few jokes, considering all the scandal that has surrounded his administration, and considering that he showed up
right,
knowing that. I mean, it's a little bit like Donald Trump showing up in 2011 to the White House Correspondents' Association dinner and getting really ripped by the president. But you know, on the one hand, I think people who are saying there were too many jokes about Chris Christie's weight have a point. At some point, if someone's heavy, I don't know how much hay you really want to make out of that. On the other hand, you know, I wrote a column for the New York Daily News back in 2011 where I argued that Christie's weight and to the extent that people give him grief about it actually helps him because it makes him seem regular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people think of politicians as these aloof, you know, almost too blow-dried and airbrushed people, and the fact that he's this kind of portly guy makes him come across to average people as a regular person, and so I don't think it actually hurts him that much in the long term.
Yeah, well, I didn't think we'd talk about him, but as long as you brought him up, how much has he been hurt in the long term, and what's the status of this whole Bridgegate? Lots of investigations still going on?
Well, yeah, and I'm not doing reporting on this story specifically, you know, because so much of what I cover is the relationship of national politics to the black and Latino electorate,
right.
And I do a lot of reporting on that. I was really kind of digging in on the Chris Christie story when he first won re-election for governor in November with such a sizable percentage of the minority electorate. He had a half of the Latino vote in New Jersey, something like 20%, the exit poll showed, of the African-American electorate in New Jersey, which is almost unheard of for a Republican these days. But that story has faded because the bigger story clearly now is this whole question that all your listeners are well aware of, is what did he know and when with regard to the Bridgegate thing and some of these other ancillary things. So I have not been right up on it, but I will just simply tell you, Kathleen, that I think his presidential prospects have been significantly hampered, whether or not it turns out that he actually knew about some of this stuff ahead of time or whether or not he's involved in any kind of conspiracy, I don't know. But I do feel pretty confident that he's going to have a much tougher climb in the presidential race, if for no other reason than until he was sort of winged, he really was holding that mainline Republican lane all to himself. The reason I think we've seen Jeb Bush emerge so much in recent weeks as a possible contender and a lot of buzz around him is because Christie no longer can hold down that lane all by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically created a way for Bush to get into the game. And I think, and maybe secondarily some folks like Scott Walker, your governor in Wisconsin.
Right.
So I think that's really the problem facing Christie.
Yeah. And another joke, I like the one when he was talking to Fox News. You know, it is amazing what this president has gone through. Let's face it, Fox, you'll miss me when I'm gone. It will be harder to convince the American people that Hillary was born in Kenya.
Yeah. That one did make me smile. You know, the Republicans, not necessarily the most prominent Republicans, but there's a lot of people in the Republican and Tea Party base really fueled the flames of that birther thing for so long that I think it's basically fair game for the president to keep going back and back to that well. You can tell by the look on his face when he delivers the joke that it never gets old to him, for me, just as an observer, it doesn't get old either, because I think that thing just got way out of hand. I think that it also sort of says a larger truth about the Obama era. I mean, it's, you know, there is lots of legitimate criticism about the president from the left and right at this point. Clearly, even people that still support him the luster is off of Obama as this, you know, charismatic figure. He's just a president like every other president at this point, doing what he does, and people agree or disagree. But I do think there is some truth to what he was saying, Kathleen, about the fact that Fox News really will miss him when he's gone, because he has been such a foil for that sort of right-leaning cable news coverage to react to. And I do think that when whoever the next president is, they're just not going to, he's not going to fit, he or she, I should say, is not going to fit their formula quite as well, for whatever reason.
So it might fuel the ratings of, say, MSNBC if a Republican were elected?
It probably will. I, I'm not going to speculate to say who I think will win. I think at this point it could go either way. We're way too early to start making educated predictions. But, yeah, MSNBC probably would benefit in their ratings from a Republican president. I mean, think about it. The Keith Olbermans of the world rose to prominence when they had Bush as a foil. And
sure did.
Thing, you know, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, as we're looking at the president's record, you wrote a really interesting column, a piece about Obama's record comparing just fine with LBJ's in conjunction with this civil rights summit that took place at the presidential library, and the president getting some criticism that he wasn't as much of a wheeler dealer, didn't know how to strong arm, if that's the right word or phrase, people in Congress to get them to pass his significant pieces of legislation. Fair criticism or too hard on the president, on President Obama?
Yeah, I think that that is a slightly unfair criticism of the president when people compare him to Lyndon Johnson and they say, oh, he hasn't gotten the raft of major legislation done that Lyndon Johnson did. You know, it's one thing, Kathleen, to say whether people, your listeners or voters in general, like what the president's done, what President Obama's done, or whether what he's done has ultimately made a difference. I think that's a very fair debate. But this idea that he just can't get anything done, I just don't think holds up. He got the Affordable Care Act done. He got the Lilly Ledbetter Act done. He got, and I'm just, of course, going off of a partial list. He got the stimulus package done early in his presidency. You know, he followed through exactly on what he said he would do with regard to wars. He got out of Iraq as fast as possible, and he stayed in Afghanistan as long as possible, which is what he promised to do. There's been a lot of other minor legislation. He's gotten trade deals done with Colombia and South Korea. I mean, I could go on and on with a laundry list. I think the point is that he's done a lot. Whether or not people are happy with it is another question. And and LBJ, I should just add, if you bear with me, the LBJ started out with a large majority in the House and the Senate, and he got most of the stuff in his presidency done when he had those large majorities, similar to Obama. Once Obama lost his party's majority in the House of Representatives, that's when things slowed down. I think they compare very similarly.
Yeah. And what about the Affordable Care Act, David? Do you see public opinion changing on this, or is it still going to be something that will serve the Republicans well in these midterm elections if they campaign hard against it?
I think there's been a lot of political gnashing of teeth on both sides all the way back to 2009. And in some ways, Kathleen, we're still fundamentally at the same place we were 5 years ago, which is that when you break down issue by issue what people do and don't like about the bill, people tend to have a more favorable view of these issues. Like, they like the fact that people can keep their kids on their insurance plan longer. They like the idea of community ratings so that people can, pay the same amount for insurance regardless of their pre-existing conditions. They like this idea that people who have pre-existing conditions can get insurance. They like the general concept of more people being insured rather than less people being insured. But when you take the whole Affordable Care Act as a whole thing, and then you throw in the individual mandate, this idea of people being required to have insurance, it polls much less favorably with the public. And I think that's due to two things. One is we tend to have, especially nowadays, this skepticism of these big omnibus bills. And then the other thing, I think, is that even for people who are in favor of universal health care, there is that little twinge of feeling like, wow, people are forced to buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very tough, I'm not suggesting that there's a better way that's been proposed out there to do it right now, given the political landscape. But I will say that I do think that that's an obstacle that the White House has never quite overcome in its political calculus. And I'm more aware of the political dynamics. I can't pretend to say that I've crunched every number on in terms of costs of premiums and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to be talking about this early in All Things Political, but there is this news today from Las Vegas. A Nevada congressman is calling on elected officials in the state to rid a town in his district of militia members who have rallied around rancher Cliven Bundy in his battle with federal land managers. In encampments around the ranch, self-described militia members from around the country continue to camp with handguns on their hips and heavier weaponry within reach in a show of support for Bundy.
Yeah, I think, is that story referring to Representative Steve Horsford from Las Vegas?
Yes.
So, you know, it's this, I just heard that particular news story when your show was doing the news at the top of the hour, but I have seen statements that Congressman Horsford has been making in the last couple of weeks, and I think it is really, as you note, a really fascinating situation, Kathleen. You've got this guy, a relatively young African-American Democratic congressman from Las Vegas, which is a very diverse and, you know, sort of new America type of city, but in the outlying areas in his district, the less populated areas in this district, you do have, you know, folks like Clive and Bundy out there who are ranchers, who've been around since a different sort of era in our history, who maybe are looking at things from a more, you know, right-leaning point of view or anti-government point of view. And he's attracted these folks in, and Congressman Horsford is in this unusual position of he's got some constituents who are cheering on these outsiders coming in armed, and then he's got a lot of constituents, probably more of the people that elected him, who are saying, whoa, people are coming into our district, into our community, you know, armed to the teeth
right.
in support of Bundy, and he really is in a rock and a hard place. I think he has acquitted himself probably better than some of the other Nevada politicians in this regard. You know, Senator Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, I think was a little inflammatory when he called Bundy a domestic terrorist. I mean, you know, whether or not he thinks that, there was a better way, clearly, to say that, to try and de-escalate the situation. When you're talking about Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval or the other Nevada Senator Dean Heller, they initially came out in support of Bundy's cause before they really even knew the facts in the case. So I do think Horsford is trying his best to see, you know, from my vantage point, to try and de-escalate the situation. But he's in a very, very tough place.
It must be very frightening to live in that area, to have all of these people armed, and they're not entirely reasonable. And some of the rhetoric that has come from Bundy has been so sensational and so wrong. It's a situation that's ripe for no good.
Well, you know, it's ripe for no good, and I think that, you know, where do you start with the Clive and Bundy situation?
Right.
I mean, what I think is problematic about Bundy and his supporters is not just this idea that they are going to take up arms at the first sign of disagreement with the federal government. It's that their case is very incoherent. I mean, even the people who came out the strongest sympathizing with Bundy acknowledged right up front 2 or 3 weeks ago that legally he really didn't have a leg to stand on. So once you've acknowledged that, what you're kind of arguing, if you're still in Bundy's camp, is that if you lose a legal dispute with the government, then that's, you know, that's cause to take up arms against the government. And I'm just not sure he's made the convincing case that they are justified in taking that logical leap. Then a week or two later, which is now a week or two ago, when he got into these comments about the quote-unquote the Negro, and saying that, you know, not saying, but maybe suggesting or musing that black people might have been better off during slavery times. I mean, now he's gone from it's incoherent to clearly this guy just doesn't know what he's talking about.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, you know, I don't know. If Congressman Horsford, he's got a real situation on his hands.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for David, and here's how you can reach our All Things Political Conversation. David Zwerdlik is our guest, associate editor at TheRoot.com. Some of you probably saw the White House. You're junkies just like we are, political junkies, that is, and you want to comment on what you saw there. We have yet to get to the affirmative action case that the Supreme Court was looking at last week, and our guest says the tension between Roberts and Sotomayor's view is the same tension fundamentally among most Americans. Where do we stand on affirmative action? Does it have a place today or not? We'll be looking at the situation of the kidnapping of hundreds of Nigerian schoolgirls and whether or not the president of Nigeria is doing enough to find out where they are and if there's anything the United States can do to bring pressure on him to find out where they are. What about the president? David wrote this interesting column about Obama's record and comparing it just fine with LBJ's. Do you worry that the president has not been able to use government to bring about the change that he promised? Or would you, as David suggests, say that in the last 5 years he has a whole list of accomplishments here? And whatever else you'd like to bring up, okay? Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. You can also send us a message at talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We do want to also thank you to everyone who contributed during our spring membership drive. We had more than 2,600 listeners pledge, including 700 sustaining pledges, and we're pleased to welcome 565 new members to WPR. You donated over $344,000 to fund all of the programs here that you depend on Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you very, very much. Again, join us, 800-486-8655. All Things Political is what you're listening to for this Monday, the 5th of May. David's word like this hour for All Things Political, and let's go to Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good afternoon. I would like to just return for a moment to the Cliven Bundy issue. I wrote to my congressman, Congressman Reed Ribble of the 8th District, a Republican congressman in Washington, D.C., and I just received a few days ago a response from him, and this was concerning the Cliven Bundy issue. I'd like to just read you three sentences that from his response, mm-hmm. which was extremely short. Thank you for contacting me about the current situation between Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and the Bureau of Land Management. I agree with you that we are a nation of laws and policies that have been in place for decades and must be followed. I believe Cliven Bundy should certainly pay any grazing fees he owes. However, I also believe that the government should not overreach in its behavior, and I'm concerned about the militarization of federal agencies, including the Bureau of Land Management, in this situation. It appears to me that he's not concerned at all because he does not mention any of the militant or militia organizations or individuals who are terrorizing, as it were, people in the area, and yet he's extremely hostile to people that work for our government and not concerned at all about their safety. So those are my comments, and I'll just hang up.
Thank you. Listen. Thanks, Reed. David.
Yeah, no, Reed, I appreciate the observation, and it sounds like you wrote a very penetrating letter to your congressman, Congressman Ribble. And I would say this, in defense of Congressman Ribble's response, I guess, is that Republicans are probably feel like they're in a tough position there, because initially a lot of major Republican figures made a hero out of Bundy, and now they've sort of backed off of it. And I'm sure Congressman Ribble was probably trying to walk a fine line. But if I gather the sense of the letter you wrote him and based on his response, I think there are some problems with what Congressman Ribble said. One would be that, how can you describe the BLM as being militarized? In other words, like every other government agency, they have armed law enforcement officers. They're probably a little more advanced than park rangers in terms of their level of law enforcement capability or response capability. But they are these guys out here tasked with patrolling these vast swatches of federal land, up to and including being armed and having police-style equipment and arms, et cetera. As far as the folks that are coming into town armed in support of Bundy, right? I mean, you have a situation where it's like people have the right to bear arms in this country, and people have the right to be on whatever side of the issue that they want. It's not clear to me that they have the right to cross state lines with their arms, and, you know, licensed in one state and maybe crossing state lines into another state. And it's not clear to me that that these folks have the right to resist a lawful government or a lawful court order with arms. And I think that is where Bundy's position comes into play problematically. If I can just add, Kathleen, that,
sure.
you know, it's hard to imagine that if this guy didn't cut this picturesque pose, an older, you know, windblown guy in a big 10-gallon hat out there on his ranch with his cattle evokes a particular image that people tend to be sympathetic of. But if you had a person who looked differently or sounded differently or was in a different geographic location, the idea that people would come to someone's defense lawfully resisting a court order,
right,
is a little bit laughable. I mean, let's just say someone in Milwaukee was being evicted from their apartment because they hadn't paid the rent and their landlord had gone through all the steps to get them evicted, and the sheriff came to enforce that eviction. That person might be a sympathetic figure, and we might feel bad for them. We might even send them some money so that they can make rent. What we wouldn't do is condone them pulling out a gun to try and keep the sheriff from evicting them. And I think that's the problem that we're facing.
I was just imagining what you were saying. Can you imagine that happening in an African-American community where people in the same block and were very segregated here would rally to the defense and bring their guns to the person and sort of camp out outside the house? How long do you think that would last, David?
Yeah, it just wouldn't. It just wouldn't fly. And I think
no.
That's the double standard in the Clive and Bundy situation, and it's unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris sends this email. The Journal Sentinel is reporting that UW Whitewater is among 55 colleges and universities being investigated over their handling of sexual abuse complaints under Title IX. Interesting timing, since the Obama administration seeks to shed greater transparency on the issue of sexual assault in higher education and how it's being handled. What does your guest think?
Well, no, I think Chris brings up a timely issue. I will say that I don't cover the sexual assault issue a lot, but so I can't probably shed more light on it than that story or some of the current reports. I will say, though, that in my role as an editor and working with writers who are covering this story, I will just say that I have learned a tremendous amount in the last year or two over the issue that's been covered in terms of sexual assault in the military, and I think philosophically this extends to sexual assault on college campuses. We have this problem that I think in past times has been underreported and underdiscussed in our society, that people in the military, whether you're talking about the military or college campuses, I think, you know, it's not always the case, but a tendency for a lot of folks to be in their 20s, that there's this huge problem of sexual assault and us in society not having clear boundaries over where the line is drawn over sexual assault when it's people who know each other. And we still, even in 2014, Kathleen, have this idea that that pervades in certain institutions, this idea that if a sexual assault is not that, you know, sort of a stereotypical case of someone jumping out of the bushes and attacking someone, that there's this gray area, and we've got to keep talking about it until we have some clarity in our society around the fact that so many people, particularly women, but sometimes men, report having been sexually assaulted at some point in their life, and frequently by someone they
yes.
know or it's in close proximity
yeah.
to them. It's awful.
It is awful. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, you just brought up Obamacare, and I, as a person who voted for Mr. Obama twice, what outrages me about it, I'm way to the left. I'm so far to the left, people really don't know how to categorize me. But what really outrages me about it, I, as a working American, I couldn't afford health care till I reached the age of 43 and I joined a union. Then I could afford health insurance. Now, from the age of 18 to 43, if I had been forced into doing that, maybe I wouldn't have been able to pay my rent or whatever. And we in this country have never, ever been forced to pay for anything. And the second issue there is the public option. Why Mr. Obama did not fight for single-payer public option just outraged me totally. He could have took the money out of this ridiculous military budget. And what you just mentioned about crossing state lines with weapons, sir, doesn't the Constitution apply to all the states? And isn't the Second Amendment what we're talking about, and the Constitution apply to all the states, or are some states exempt from the Constitution?
David.
Yeah, let me take those in reverse order, and I appreciate, Ray, that you're keeping me honest here. I should say that when I clearly have not interviewed every single person who's come into Nevada on the side of Clive and Bundy. I do think generally, though, that weapons are licensed by state, and more often than not, with state law, having a license to carry or use a firearm in one state is not a license to use or carry a firearm in another state. But you are absolutely right, Ray, that the Second Amendment right to bear arms, however different people and different judges and different states interpret it, is a constitutional right that applies to everyone in the United States. With regard to Obamacare, I guess I would say this. The short answer to the question of why didn't President Obama push harder for the public option would be that he and his administration didn't think they could get the votes. That's not an excuse. I mean, there is certainly an argument to be made, and you characterize yourself, Ray, as someone who's coming from the far left. And I think there was certainly a progressive or a left-leaning argument to be made that the president should have gone for the public option, or something that could have been called Medicare for All. And it might have been simpler both to craft legislation around that, and it might have been simpler to argue that case in public. It's not clear to me, though, that they would have been able to get the 60 votes in the U.S. Senate in 2010 that they needed for that plan. I do think that the Obama administration, if they've had one... Ironically for them, their largest legislative accomplishment, the Affordable Care Act, their signature, if you will, is also the one where I think it was fraught with the most political mistakes, and I think it's one of those things where it does, on one hand, lend some credence to this idea that if President Obama had been in the Senate for another term or so, that he might have had a little more sway with some of his colleagues. I'm not sure how much, but maybe a little bit. But on the other side of that argument is that I'm sure that the administration was probably looking at this and saying, look, we want to get health care legislation passed, and what we think we can get passed is Romney Care, essentially. Let's take the Mitt Romney plan from Massachusetts, and surely we'll get a handful of Republicans to go along with this. And I don't know this for a fact, but I would guess that they were genuinely surprised when no Republicans
yes.
would go for it. And I think that set the tone for our politics for the last 5 years
yeah.
once that happened.
Thanks, Ray, very much for the call. Before we go back to phone calls, let's talk about the Supreme Court decision last week concerning affirmative action, ruling that the 14th Amendment was not violated when Michigan voters did away with race-conscious admissions. You say that you will not be surprised to see more and more states copy what Michigan voters did in 2006. Affirmative action no longer needed, no longer popular, evidently.
Yeah, I definitely don't think it's popular any longer. Polls taken within the last few months show that a majority of Americans think that we're ready to move on from affirmative action policies. So whether or not there's people see the value in it, people are clearly ready to move on. And I think what I wrote about, Kathleen, is that I think what people out there in the public think is basically articulated, or at least a narrow majority of people, is basically articulated by Justice Roberts when he said famously in a prior case, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race.
Right.
As if to say, if you want to get rid of discrimination, then don't have laws that separate people out by race. And I do think that is a prevalent view among our electorate and among Americans. And what skipping ahead to this recent case, the Chouette case, Justice Sotomayor, dissenting against the majority, gave a rejoinder that, saying the way to stop discrimination is to talk openly and honestly about the subject of race. And in her view, as she explained, that part of discussing it open and honestly was to acknowledge that race still matters in so many aspects
mm-hmm.
of American life, both private and public. But she and I and looking at her dissent, I think she wrote a really eloquent dissent and defense of her position. But it was a 6-2 vote, and clearly she's in the side that has the diminishing viewpoint. So I do think now this case is going to lead to more states having ballot measures where affirmative action is voted out by the voters, because in one sense, Kathleen, it was this very narrow legal holding. The court didn't rule, as your listeners know, the court didn't rule that affirmative action was unconstitutional. It simply ruled that it was not required constitutionally, mm-hmm. and so voters can get rid of it, and I do think that that's what's going to happen.
We have to talk about voter ID. Appeals judge saying that Wisconsin's law was unconstitutional, and evidently there is not enough time before the midterm elections to make voter ID a reality here in the state of Wisconsin. We will talk with David about that as well. David Zwerdlich is our guest, and you are listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. We're welcoming your phone calls, your contributions to our political discussion. Anybody see the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Where are all you political junkies? Which jokes did you think were really funny and which were maybe over the top? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, this would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday. There's a big festival that will honor his contributions to music and keeping alive folk music, and also his really extraordinary life and his battles against, his battles for social justice. So we're going to be talking about Pete Seeger, hour two of our show today. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Zwerdlich, who is associate editor of TheRoot.com, is our guest. And let's go to Tyler in Appleton next. Hello, Tyler.
Hi there.
Hi.
First of all, I just want to say I did not see the Correspondents' Dinner, but it couldn't have been anywhere near as good if Stephen Colbert wasn't there. I also wanted to say that I don't understand why people are putting so much stock into the issue about Cliven Bundy. I don't think he really had a leg to stand on ever, and I think that a certain major news network made a big deal out of it so they could make a point for a Tea Party, and I think it's really unimportant. I think what we really should be talking about is things like net neutrality, which are being, eroded away right now. And I don't see any of that on the news at all. That's all I had to say.
All right. Thank you. What about net neutrality? Are you covering that at all?
You know, we had a piece on The Root about that a couple of months ago. With net neutrality, I can honestly say I see both sides of the argument. Mm. I do think that it really is problematic when big carriers, it's like so many aspects of our society, whether you're talking about big box stores or big oil or anybody, when the bigger companies can squeeze out the smaller guys by refusing to carry their content, you have a problem in terms of the free flow of ideas and a variety and a mixture of conversation on the internet. The internet is something that's there for everybody, in a sense, like the airwaves. On the other hand, I don't think net neutrality is outside of that tradition. So if we have this tradition where the big guy squeezes the little guy and the big bookstore squeezes the local bookstore, I'm not sure that it's hard to see where we can hold internet providers to one set of standards and not hold all these other corporate retailers to another set of standards. This is I'm doing my best to walk the line on this one, Kathleen.
You've done a really good job, David.
This is one where I think I can still be swayed by Tyler's view or a different view. This is one
right.
where I've thought a lot about it, but don't come down hard and fast on one side of it. To Tyler's point about the Bundy issue, the only thing I would add would be that if he had not made those comments that were racial in nature, I do think you'd still see a lot of major Republican figures coming out in support of him.
Right.
And I do think that's problematic, the most prominent of which was Senator Rand Paul, who is a very likely Republican presidential contender in 2016. So I think that's why the issue had legs.
Federal judge ruled Wisconsin's voter ID, which the governor had said was the most important issue, really a very important issue to him, and he was going to call the legislature back into a special session. But evidently that's not going to happen at this point in time. A federal judge saying that this is just unconstitutional. Are there a lot of other laws like this one, and are they facing similar court rejection or still in the process of court deliberation?
You know, this, there's two in my mind hodgepodges going on with this one and with regards to Wisconsin. On the one hand, you've got the particulars of voter ID and all the different the patchwork of cases and laws and court decisions going on with that. Now you've got Wisconsin, right? I mean, you your show, most of your listeners are in Wisconsin, and I got to say, I've been fascinated watching Wisconsin. You've got a little secession movement going on,
right,
amongst the small, narrow group of it. You've got Scott Walker, who is sort of this dark horse contender for the presidency. You've got Paul Ryan with all of his ups and downs as a high-profile member of Congress. And then you've got this voter ID situation. Oh, and the chair of the National Republican Party is from Wisconsin. Wisconsin's like the center of the political universe.
We are, right? I know.
I have talked twice. I know I can speak less about the court cases than I can about having spoken twice to Chairman Reince Priebus in the last couple of months,
mm-hmm.
once in person and once on a conference call for reporters. And he has maintained that these are good faith efforts to get rid of voter fraud. And it's something that I'm not so sure about, because there's not a lot of data showing that voter fraud has been a major issue in Wisconsin or a lot of other states where these laws are being put forth. And then you have this additional issue of you know, you guys in Wisconsin had this issue of limiting early voting. And
yes.
I think there was a thing where finally member of the state ledge, was it Schultz, who broke ranks
Dale
with the
Schultz.
Other Republicans,
right,
and said, wait a second, look, what's really happening is the party wants to keep a more urban, more black and Latino, younger, senior part of the electorate at home in the midterms. And so I think this has become a problematic thing for Republicans. You know, I don't know how it's going to turn out on a nationwide basis, but I think Republicans have been effective in pushing back against the Voting Rights Act at the Supreme Court level, but I don't think that they've been as effective in getting some of these, a lot of these local or state level rulings have gone against them as it did in Wisconsin. Yeah.
Let's go to Joan next in Wisconsin. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I was responding to Left of Left.
Uh-huh.
It seems not true that we have never been required to buy insurance. We all buy in car insurance, and it's certainly by requirement. I don't quite see the difference.
I have a short answer for that.
Make sure we're not all paying for every accident.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of health insurance, part of it is we're not paying much larger bills from the emergency rooms.
David.
Well, I think that's a good analogy, and that was one of the analogies that was talked about a lot when the law was first proposed at the federal level by the Obama administration in 2009-2010. Here's the key difference, I think. You are not required to drive a car on the public thoroughfares. And so what the government is essentially requiring you, your state is requiring you, if you drive, you must have insurance. But you are not required to drive in the first place, I guess, is the distinction. Whereas with health care, you are you already. So you are, whether you have a health status to start with, and so you're just being required by the federal government to have some form of coverage, whether it's your employer or through the exchanges or Medicaid, et cetera. And that would be the distinction. Anybody can opt out of automobile insurance by just not driving. And I guess it may be a fine distinction, but it's a distinction nonetheless.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit. I thought it was interesting you wrote about Senator Cory Booker and his political rise. I wasn't aware of this bill that he's jointly sponsoring with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. What is that bill, and what is his political future, Booker's?
So Senator Booker and Senator Scott are the only two African Americans in the U.S. Senate. One is a Democrat, one is a Republican, and they are both in their first term. Booker, most recently, as your listeners know, was the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. Tim Scott was a congressman from South Carolina. They were both appointed to fill the seats of outgoing, or in the case of Senator Lautenberg, deceased senators. And, Cory Booker won a special election. But in any case, they're both new to the Senate. They are teaming up on this bill to provide incentives for employers in specific targeted industries to provide paid apprenticeships for skilled workers in skilled trades. And the idea is to give tax incentives. I believe it's $1,500 for every in tax incentives for these employers for every paid apprenticeship that they provide to people under the age of 29 in skilled trades. And then there's $1,000, slightly less, for apprenticeships and skilled trades for people between 29 and 40, I think. And the idea is that a lot of economists and a lot of observers say that we have a gap where we've got 3 to 4 million skilled trade positions unfilled because there aren't enough skilled people to fill those jobs. Not everyone agrees with that. Paul Krugman, who is clearly on the left, but clearly is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, disputes the idea that there should be or that there would be this many unfilled positions if industry was more willing to hire. But a lot of people take the opposite view and say that the only way to get people in these jobs is to have skilled apprenticeships or more job training, et cetera. So what these two senators have come together in what they hope will be a bipartisan way of attacking the problem to get companies to provide paid apprenticeships as opposed to unpaid internships. On paper, I think it's a really good idea. One thing I wonder is A, can they get it passed in this Congress, and B, will it really result in any foreseeable framework of time in 3 or 4 million jobs being filled? I mean, you know, that seems like a pretty tall order for one piece of legislation. But this is what they've kind of led out with as in this idea of the only two black senators wanting to work across the aisle together. And I think that, at a minimum, the bipartisanship effort is laudable. Whether or not the bill actually works is another question.
Yeah, it's a story that should be highlighted, a nice example of bipartisanship. Those stories are few and far between.
Exactly. And Tim Scott, when he was in the House, was a little more of a vocal critic of the Obama administration, a little more of a Tea Party bent to his rhetoric. And now that he's in the Senate and representing an entire state, he is, I think, trying to moderate his views to be more of a moderate Republican critic of the president. To your question, Kathleen, about what Cory Booker will do in the future, a lot of people wonder if he will run for president. I don't rule that out. He certainly has enough ambition to do that. I am skeptical, though, if, you know, he will still be in the limelight when an opportunity arises 8 or 12 or 16 years from now. I think it's more likely that he'll become a fixture in the Senate like a Ted Kennedy, sort of a reliable, a powerful Democrat. I find it hard to see a guy, particularly a guy who in his mid-40s isn't married, making a serious run at the presidency. I feel like as a country we have a bias toward candidates who have a picturesque family life, and he's still a bachelor, so I don't know if that'll.
How many picturesque family lives are there, really?
Well, the Obamas, I think, are.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. I know. Yeah, it's one of the things we love about him.
Yeah, love him or hate him, President Obama definitely has that Norman Rockwell type.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yes, he does. Just finally, I don't want to ignore this story, but we only have about 45 seconds left. Can the United States do anything to put pressure on the Nigerian president to find out where these young girls are? This story really became a big story because of the protests all over the world over the weekend.
Yeah, story's still developing. I think there probably are things we can do, but, you know, we should remember, too, that while the U.S. has influence with any country, really, Nigeria is a country with like 100 million people, and they have oil reserves. They're an oil exporter, and after South Africa and Egypt, probably the biggest military on the African continent. So they're not as susceptible to our, you know, carrots and sticks as the smaller countries might be. I also think it could be a double-edged sword for any administration to get involved in a situation where, as tragic as it is that these schoolgirls have been kidnapped, abducted from their school. There's rumors that they're going to be sold into marriage or sold into slavery in other countries. When you're talking about us and any organization that is a self-proclaimed Islamic fundamentalist organization, there's almost incentive for these organizations to resist anything the United States is working on or proposing, in my view. So yeah. I think it's a double-edged sword there.
Thank you, David. Always a great pleasure to speak with you.
I enjoyed it, Kathleen.
I did too. Thanks. David Zwerdlich, he is associate editor at TheRoot.com, our guest for All Things Political this Monday. You always hear All Things Political Mondays at 1. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and also for doing our on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls, everybody. Please stay tuned. We have news coming up from NPR, and then we'll celebrate the life of Pete Seeger.